Well, boy, it's a real pleasure and a genuine honor for me to be here to talk to you all for the reasons we discussed. My wife teaches school. I consider it to be very important. We are the people who are doing... I'm sorry. Oh, I'm on the wrong side. Yes. We are the people doing science, but you are the people who are projecting into the future, and that's exceedingly important to me personally. Now, let's see how this aspect ratio works. I think it's okay here. The title of my talk today is Mesoscopic Protection. And so I believe I need to explain to you what mesoscopic is, and I need to explain to you what protection is. Now, y'all mostly are high school teachers, so probably you think you know what protection is. But I don't mean that. I don't mean that kind. Right. Yes. And I have to tell you, I have my father-in-law is a Yankee, a very wonderful. We were eating lobster at his house one day, and I used to like economics, but I don't now. And I said, why? And he said, well, it was great until they made it into a science. And for better or worse, that's relevant because one aspect of physics is philosophy. Physics always has had a philosophical component, and there are very broad principles of nature that we're trying to understand as human beings, and we talk about nature in terms of equations and numbers, but the thing we're after is something a little deeper. Now, did anybody explain today why superconductivity happens? Anybody? I don't remember that they did. This is, of course, a planted question because no one ever explains why we have superconductivity. We do have approximate descriptions, but superconductivity is exact. Right? Exact. The little magnet floats on the superconductor forever. It levitates itself. You can't describe exact things in terms of approximate equations. Perfectly obvious that you can't. If you have something exact in nature that you come across, it means something deeper than simply details. And that idea is what we're talking about this afternoon. The idea has a very esoteric name in physics. We call it fixed point of renormalization group. David Pines and I thought that was a little dense, so we invented a new name for it, which we call protection. So I'm going to tell you now about the broader implications of superconductivity and a very big and fascinating idea about the way nature organizes itself called protection. Now, I hesitate to show this slide because I have an anti-string theory talk I give. But I will anyway because it says a lot. There's a lot of talk nowadays about attempts to discover a theory of everything. This is, of course, one of the ways of understanding what physics is. All of us, with no exceptions, including myself, who work in physics are reductionists. We are looking for ultimate reasons for things. What I've written in that box up there is the canonical example of reasons for things. That equation, it doesn't matter that you don't understand what it is. Just take my word for it. That's the wave equation for non-relativistic matter. So that's the equation that allegedly describes all of chemistry, all of people-scale physics. There's no gravity in there. There's no light in there. There's no nuclear forces in there. But for the world in which I live, this is more or less a theory of everything. And when I mean everything, I mean specifically these things. This is one of my favorites. Now, we're talking about the important things in life here, folks. Lawyers are the same thing as the Ebola virus, I think. At any rate, this is one of the favorite jokes of physics. We like to talk about the spherical cow approximation. We are modeling more complicated things in nature using our equations. Of course, you can't compute those things from the underlying equations. And it's pretty obvious that would be silly. But maybe it's not so obvious why it's silly. You see, the behaviors that are implicit in the things I've written up there are actually very simple. They are things you encounter every day in your life. They're part of the natural world. They allegedly follow deductively from the underlying equations. And yet, they really can't. The problem here in our understanding of quantum nature is that this little innocent here is over 10 to the 23rd things. So these Schrodinger waves that are being described by this time evolution operator are moving in 10 to the 23rd dimensions. And that means that it's hard to solve. And even for me. So this is the reason why, technically, you can't describe those things with the ultimate equation. Now, the issue on the table is, why are there simple things in the world, even though the deductive path from the original equation to that thing doesn't exist? Lawyers are not simple, but rocks are kind of simple, and transistors are modeled after them, and our understanding of rocks and minerals is what led to the communications revolution. So there certainly are things in nature that are understandable. Now, the answer we know now is this. There are two major threads in physics. There are sort of two major logical threads. One is the reductionist ideal, where we're looking for the ultimate equations of things. And the other is the rules by which matter assembles itself. And you look around you anywhere in the world, you will see evidence of what we call higher organizing principles. The matter described by the equations of quantum mechanics assembles itself, all by itself, into assemblages which have amazing properties. And in principle, these properties flow deductively from the underlying equations. But in fact, that's not the gist of it. The essence of it is that they are caused by principles. Now, you saw earlier today an example of this upper thing, which we call the Meissner effect, where we pour on some liquid nitrogen and the little blue magnet there levitates itself and begins twirling about. And we talked about its being forever. Well, that is an example of a higher organizing principle of nature that we call continuous broken symmetry. Superconductivity is one of its most elegant manifestations, but there are many others. The reason that the superconductor remains levitated forever is not because we have equations that we can solve that proves it. It's because the electrons in the superconductor are organizing themselves all by themselves into a new state of matter. Now, we can turn it around. I like to turn it around and say, science is an experimental endeavor. We look at nature and infer things from what we see. So when you see an exact thing in nature, that's the tip off that there is a higher organizing principle at work. In fact, maybe even stronger, that's the proof of it. It's because of these things, things like this, that we know that there are such principles. Here's another example of hate you. Here's another example. Some higher being is angry at me, I think. Electrical effects in the helium. Here is one of these exact effects that's very close to my heart. This was discovered in 1980 by Klaus von Klitzing, called the quantum Hall effect. This little gizmo here is a little semiconductor. It's about a millimeter long, and that picture is supposed to be you're looking down on it. And the B here means there's a magnetic field pointing up. And then you solder a lead onto the ends and force a current to flow along the axis of the semiconductor, and then measure voltages. And when the sample is very cold, you find that the voltage drop between this pad and this one, which is plotted here, it's a function of the field strength, has regions where it's zero. So it looks as though there's no resistive loss in the direction the current is going. And then at the same time, the voltage drop between this pad and this one, which is plotted here, becomes very, very flat. And it's so flat that you can measure it very accurately. You can measure it accurate. It's the same to a part in 10 to the 8 at least. And the number that you get is a combination of fundamental constants, Planck's constant over the electric charge square, divided by an integer. So that's exact. Let me point out that both Planck's constant and the electric charge squared appear in the fundamental equations, but the deductive path from those fundamental equations to the answer doesn't exist. So the fact that this combination of fundamental constants appears exactly in a solid-state physics experiment that's quite dirty and quite imperfect is evidence that there is a higher organizing principle that makes it work, that will make sure that the result is exactly the same every time you do this experiment, regardless of details. Now, the principle in this case has a name. It's called localization. Been known for a long time. It's just one of many. Here are a couple of examples of these principles that are a little less esoteric and better known to you. I've shown just a plain Ohm's law experiment in a metal. So that's we force a current down the axis of a metal in no magnetic field and measure the voltage drop, and then discover that the resistance thus measured as a function of temperature saturates at zero temperature to some number. This is a purely quantum mechanical phenomenon. It does not require any kind of thermal jostling to occur. Occurs at absolute zero temperature, and it is a phenomenon unique to a state of matter that we call the Fermi liquid. Fermi liquid is the prototype for, it's just, Fermi liquid is Latin for conventional metal. The fact that conventional metals continue to be conventional metals all the way down to arbitrarily low temperatures is astonishing. It's astonishing fact of quantum mechanics. And probably you wouldn't believe it unless you'd seen it experimentally. And perhaps the most humble example of all, ordinary sound. Here I've drawn a picture of a sound transducer on one side of a brick and a microphone on the other. And we do this experiment and we find that the sound waves will propagate through. There will be two of them, a longitudinal one and a transverse, and the dispersion relation of this sound will be linear, as expected of a conventional elastic wave equation. This is always true. Doesn't matter which brick you use, doesn't matter what the brick is made of. Regardless of details, this is always true. So the behavior of a conventional metal and the behavior of conventional sound are examples of things that are quite generic. They're quite generic, they're quite universal, they don't depend on the models, and this is what I mean by protected. These things collectively define for you what I mean by protected behavior. In other words, protection, as I'm defining it here, is a fact of nature, which we deal with every day in the laboratory. I have just to show that I'm not jingoistic, here's another example. You all know that airplanes fly, and the principles by which the airplanes fly are called conventional hydrodynamics. I know of no way to prove that conventional hydrodynamics follows deductively from the wave equation. But we know that the principles of hydrodynamics are very robust. They are protected behaviors, quite generic, quite independent of the particular gases involved in making the fluid. So protected behavior is all around us in nature, and it's very important for our understanding of the natural world. Now, perhaps a little less obvious is the fact that the hubris that physicists like to show towards calculating things is related to protection. I like to say that protection facilitates computation. Now, I'm putting this up to make a point, not to cow y'all. For professional physicists, they've seen these equations a million times and don't want to see them anymore. So I just want you to know that there are such equations. This is a little ball and stick model, a ball and spring model, what worked out purely quantum mechanically. It's a problem that we give to our beginning students. And here is a thing called the quantum ground state, and you can just write it down. Let's never mind the details of what that is. The point is that after we've done this exercise, we have proved that there's a new kind of particle, new kind of elementary particle in the problem called a phonon, characterized by all the stuff in this box. Now, this is a model calculation based on balls and springs, but real nature has real phonons that come out of a Hamiltonian, which is not balls and springs. It's just the equations of ordinary matter, which are very complicated and nonlinear. In fact, the protected behavior of the phonon, the existence of this particle, is a side effect of the organization of matter into the crystal phase. The existence of crystals may be as obvious to you in nature, but I think from first principles maybe it's not so obvious to me, but they certainly do exist, and we know that when they do exist, you get sound as a quantum mechanical phenomenon automatically and necessarily. Crystallization is actually the Ur-type for continuous broken symmetries, superfluidity being the second variety. So sound, linear propagating sound, is quite protected. It's only protected at the longest length scales. Now, these are things that you're all familiar with. Probably probably you didn't think about them as being very special. But of course, the fact that they're so universal and generic means that they are quite special. They're things that are absolutely, fundamentally true, and they would continue to be true even if I tweaked the laws of quantum mechanics a little bit. They're quite profoundly true. Now, I'm getting a little ahead of myself here, but I'd like you to notice this red thing here. I've got protected. This is a plot of wave vector, 1 over wavelength, and that's a prop, that's a frequency goes up. And my point here in this picture is that protected behavior is a long length scale, low frequency scale phenomenon, as far as we know it in physics. And that means there's something special about long and slow in nature that is different from short and fast. And so when we talk about the principles of renormalization, or in my language, the principles of protection, there's something special about this limit. Now, let me point out something else, which is protection can be both good and bad. If you're trying to figure out what the behavior of the material is mechanically at long length scales, you're in business, because that behavior is quite universal. It's protected. And so you can't go wrong. You can model it any way you want and it'll come out right. But if you want to infer that there are atoms from a measurement made at long length scales and short and low frequencies, you cannot. Why? Because the thing you're measuring is protected behavior. It tells you nothing about the underlying microscopics. It's when you measure something that's generic and universal, you learn nothing about details. So you see, protection can be both good and bad depending on what you're trying to accomplish. Now, in the examples that we know from, I would call, laboratory physics, there is a natural connection between protection and size. So we might say the subtopic is that size does matter. Here's a little baby problem that we give our students sometimes. It's a very mean thing to do because we know perfectly well they can't solve it. This is a little baby Hamiltonian. Actually, it's the equations of motion, the quantum equations of motion of helium. And I had a very smart student. I wanted to find out how smart they were. So I had them solve this equation for two particles. And a student did that. And I had a student solve it for three particles. And that took longer. Then I had the student solve it for four particles. And that took very long, and he began to have a lot of anxiety. And the point is that he, of course, I knew perfectly well he'd never get beyond 10. This particular student made it to 6 before he got angry. And the point is that in none of those calculations was there the slightest shred of evidence for superfluidity. What we see is the behavior of a small molecule, a small bundle of atoms. So the message here is that when you have a very large number of particles obeying simple laws of quantum mechanics, it can happen that you get behaviors that are qualitatively different from what you see with one or two. The protected behavior that we normally talk about in condensed matter physics is all of this variety. It's the kind that occurs when you have the thermodynamic limit, an extraordinarily, stupendously large number of particles. Superfluidity is a beautiful example of a protected behavior that requires more. There is no such thing as superfluidity in 10 atoms, 100 atoms, 1,000 atoms. You have to have a mind-bogglingly large number before superfluidity can exist. Well, how big is that? How interesting. It's not definable. I like to say it's like pornography. I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. At any rate, superfluid helium doesn't exist when the number of particles is small. Now, so the concept of more is different, is a limit. is a limiting process. There's no such thing as big enough. It's only the concept of more. This is a very 90s talk, you understand. There's no such thing as enough, but there is a concept of more, and we have we have some language that we use in physics to describe what we mean by more. This language is called the renormalization group, and the basic idea of more is to imagine a series of experiments one does with samples that are bigger and bigger and bigger. The basic idea is, as you make the experiment on the sample, the behavior gets more and more protected. And so we can make a little sketch down here, which we call a renormalization plot, which describes what would happen to the thing you're measuring as the sample size gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And what we find is that the stable states of matter, like superfluids and crystals, are described by what we call attractive fixed points of the renormalization group. That is to say that the things that you measure become more and more accurately described by that number and eventually converge to it regardless of the starting point, as long as you're more or less close, as long as you're more or less nearby. But if you start too far away, you will, as we say, flow into a different behavior, which is a different state of matter. So a protected state of matter is synonymous with what one normally calls attractive fixed point of renormalization group. Now, there is a second kind of protected behavior that we know about in physics, and that's what we call repulsive fixed points. That's the universal behavior that occurs at phase transitions. So there are some kinds of phase transitions, like the liquid vapor transition between steam and water. There's some analogs of those that occur in quantum mechanics at zero temperature when you change, say, the pressure. And the low energy, long wavelength behavior of those systems are expected to be protected as well. This exhausts the categorization of protected behavior that we know. So the kinds of protected behavior that we know to occur in nature fall into one of these two categories. In either case, the existence of protection and the protected behavior itself was discovered. It was discovered in the laboratory, was not anticipated by theory. After examples of these protected behaviors were discovered, then the microscopic basis of them was understood, and now there's a great literature on both kinds. This, however, begs the issue of whether there are more. Are there more kinds of protected behavior that we haven't discovered yet? Let me mention one other thing that's of relevance. I mentioned it before, but let's do it again. In my discipline, solid-state physics, where we deal with experiments all the time, our ability to compute, to describe nature with mathematics, follows from protection. It doesn't prove protection. It's a consequence of it. So, for example, the subject of the conference this week, where we were talking about the cuprate superconductors, was extraordinarily fascinating, because at this time in history we are dealing with something that should not have been. We're dealing with a physical system that should have been perfectly computable from the laws of quantum mechanics using the approximation techniques we know, but instead has proved unreachable, out of the bounds of our alleged superior technology, which means we have to confront the fact that this technology never existed at all, never existed in the first place. The world is full of things we don't understand, and our alleged understanding of all things is in fact nothing of the sort. It is simply a list of protected behaviors that occur commonly in nature. And the moment we encounter a new one, or some protected behavior that doesn't categorize as in ways that we know, all of our much vaunted predictive power and computational ability vanishes away, and we are faced with embarrassment after embarrassment. Even the simplest imaginable model equation of motion for these new superconductors has proved completely intractable. We've learned an enormous amount about these model equations of motion, but the thing we've really learned is that the myth of computability was never true, and that the alleged mastery of all nature by knowing the underlying equations wasn't true either. Instead of walking into a new century where everything is known, we now know we're walking into a century where practically nothing is known. We were fooling ourselves. There are vast infinities of things to be discovered. Now, I said mesoscopic protection. Once you have understood that there are physical principles at work in the natural world, which are hard to deduce from macroscopists, then you begin to ask, well, what else don't we understand that sounds, you know, things that seem to work, they're exact, they seem robust, and yet we don't understand them. Obviously, the granddaddy of them all is life. Now, I'm asking a question here, is life protected? Is the machinery of life a protected behavior? The truth is, we don't know. Our understanding of protected behavior all comes at long, very large sizes. And unfortunately, the chemistry of life, or the physics, the physical behaviors of life, all occur right in there. They occur at a scale that's not small enough to be a little molecule and not really large enough to be macroscopic matter either. Now, we know that it isn't big enough for the known kinds of protection to work. But we also have no good measurements down in here that will help us discover new ones. So this devolves into politics. And it's the most fascinating thing. When we talk about the molecules of life, you'll find the physicists start out with, very much like Laura said, a belief. I believe that there are simple principles and that I will discover them. And our colleagues in the life sciences say, you are a fool. There are no principles. There is only evolution. Once I heard this topic discussed at a pan-science meeting, and one very bold student got up and said, doesn't God have something to do with it? To which the speaker said, well, yeah, but we're trying to understand how she or he did it. So in any case, the inability to measure in this length scale range is crippling. And much of our understanding of the way the machinery of life works is nothing but guesswork, prejudice, based on physical analogies we've drawn with the very large or the very small. The truth is that no one has the foggiest idea why the machinery of life is so robust. Now, I make two points here that I'm hoping you will to proselytize and you will take home to your constituents, namely the next generation of scientists. Number one, principles of organization in nature, which is what I care about, are discovered. You don't just think about them. You stumble upon them by accident in the laboratory. They're inherent experimental things. All the things in my career that I've noticed that matter have been serendipitous discoveries in the laboratory. Someone was looking for something else and stumbled on an astonishing new effect that no one had any idea was there. Now, I personally believe there are many, many more of those to be found. But you have to look for them. And it is the biggest mistake in the world to assume that you don't have to look because all things are known. That's number one. Number two, there is a measurement problem. It for better or worse, the what's going on in living things is at a scale we can't see. And that's why we don't know what's happening, is because there are no good tools that look in there. And so to find out Whether there are organizational principles involved in the scale of life will require new kinds of measurement that haven't been invented yet. So not only looking for new organization principles, but looking for the technology of the tools that will enable us to tell. Now, just in case you might worry that this is a parochial view, let me ask the rhetorical question whether the vacuum of space-time is protected. Is there any evidence that the behavior of the vacuum of space-time is regulated by principles different from those regulating ordinary matter? Interesting question. Not easy to answer because it's a rather emotional thing, but obviously by asking the question, I'm attempting to plant an idea in your head that maybe it's not. In other words, this is something a question that we would have to resolve experimentally, and unfortunately, when you're protected, there isn't any measurement you can do that will infer the true underlying equations. So if you're trying to figure out the underlying equations of the universe, and you have the unfortunate happening of the things you're measuring are protected, well, that's not so good, okay? Because it means you've got a problem. Almost certainly one would need to kick up the energy scale, kick down the length scale until one can escape protection in order for the underlying equations to be revealed. So my vision of the future of physics is that the physical analogy between the quantum mechanics of space and the quantum mechanics of materials not only is important, but I think is probably apt. And the lessons that we've learned by studying ordinary matter are apt lessons. Now, I go back to the question of the mesoscopic. I promised to tell you what protection was. Now, what is mesoscopic? Mesoscopic is the length scale that you can't see. Length scale will be all our spectroscopies that we're blind to. And as it turns out, this length scale of about 1,000 angstroms is precisely where the machinery of life operates. So we look at all the things we might investigate what is happening physically at those length scales, and we discover this long list of things we do in physics to tell is not so good. The most powerful tool for investigating this is the plain old gel, what our biochemist friends do. X-rays are too energetic and the wavelength is not right. Magnetic resonance requires crystals. Neutron scattering is not accurate enough. Scanning tunneling microscopy disrupts the system in violent and uncontrolled ways. Optical methods, scattering of light, and macroscopic heat absorption. These things are very, very long wavelength techniques that are tailor-made for studying the rocks and materials of relevance to transistors. So our battery of technologies with which we understand the microscopic world is almost non-existent when we go into this length scale. So for that reason, I think this is the problem. This is the physics problem of our era, of our time, is to search the natural world to discover if there are principles of protection operating in the machinery of life at the mesoscopic scale, and that this is that's what I want to do. Now, I think I'm going to stop because I think it's an appropriate time to stop. Thank you all for your kind attention.
Yeah.
Interesting question. Sure. Complexity theory was invented by Per Bach and other physicists of that ilk as a prototypical example of a new kind of self-organization, of protected behavior. It's and absolutely it doesn't fall into the usual categories that I put up here. What characterizes it mostly and distinguishes it from the things I talked about is its dynamic nature. The classic example of this is the formation of sand piles, the formation of the angle of repose of sand piles. In order for that to happen, you need to dribble the sand on the top in a non-equilibrium way. Another example would be fully developed turbulence. The onset of turbulence sure looks like a phase transition, something that you would see in thermal equilibrium. But in fact, there really isn't any equilibrium example, prototype of that kind of behavior. So chaos, or the development of chaotic dynamics, is an example of some universal behavior that might not categorize in the way I've said here and be important for understanding nature, yes. Yeah. Great question. He asked, what is the relationship between the conservation laws and protection? Conservation laws are properties of the underlying equations. Okay, the principles of protection emerge. So for example, energy is conserved always, but the Meissner effect doesn't happen always. If I put the little magnet on top of the metal, and it's the wrong metal, it won't levitate. It requires the reorganization of the matter into this new state, the superconducting state, in order to occur. Conservation of energy, on the other hand, as far as, well, certainly in my world, is an exact symmetry of nature associated with time invariance of the vacuum. So did I answer your question? One emerges, the other is fundamental, right? Paul? Great point. All right. No, it's not despair at all. First of all, for those of you who are not experts in superconductivity, Paul and I go to the same meetings. We argue with the same people. I have been basically raising the question again and again at these meetings that maybe there is a critical point protection principle operating the cuprates, which is bad in that it's giving you universal behavior that won't reveal in any way what the underlying machinery is, what the underlying cause of the superconductivity is. Now, this isn't not despair. It's just bringing up a question of maybe you're asking the wrong question. You see, if you've got protected behavior and you measure it again and again and again, you learn nothing except the universal properties of the critical point. Well, the right response is to find out, first of all, if it's true, and secondly, it is, stop doing that kind of measurement and do other kinds of measurements which will reveal the true underlying nature. In other words, the paradigm of BCS, how they solve superconductivity, needn't work for this problem. It's perfectly possible in my mind, but it's a different kind of problem. It's just like fighting the wrong war. You're fighting the last war rather than this war. And this war, I think there are some organizing principles that are working against you. and that for that reason, many of the measurements that have been done don't tell you as much as people think. So no, I don't think that's a negative result at all. It's pointing away forward in research to get to the bottom of things. Yes. Okay. Now, he says, he asks a great question, which is, if you don't want to use BCS theory, what do you use? Remember when Paul said, we have a qualitative theory? Now, that isn't true. Our mathematical description of superconductors is highly accurate. It's highly accurate. In fact, it's the best understood phenomenon in all of physics. But what we don't have is the ability to predict the transition temperature, big numbers of the superconducting state from first principles. That we don't have. But we do have the property of describing the low energy properties of the superconductor perfectly accurate, perfectly, using the equations of BCS. So you see, I want to divest the theory into two parts. One is the protected universal behavior, which is always correct and never wrong. And the other is the deductive path from the microscopics, which only works if you're lucky. And it's perfectly possible to jettison that part and keep the universal part and have what we would call a theory of the state that is perfectly predictive about what happens when you perturb the state, and yet not have a deductive path from microscopics, and therefore not have an answer yet to the question, what's the microscopic cause? The fact that Paul articulated it that way is fascinating, or should fascinate you all, because it reveals that we are in this subject in a Kuhnian paradigm crisis, where we can't agree on the language or even the nature of the question surrounding this new superconducting state. The bad news there is that it's very frustrating to think about the problem. The good news is that there's a major discovery there to be made, and eventually we'll work it out, and the sun will shine, and it'll be a great moment in science. Yeah, John. What a great question. Man, is it harder. You know, I like to tell the story. I got this preprint from Dan and Horst, and I flipped to the back. You know, you always do this. You flip to the look at the figure. 5 seconds, I had the idea of what it was and quickly wrote it down and sent it in. And so it was blitzkrieg. We just solved it. And I think, in retrospect, part of it was historical luck, but the big part was it's just inherently an easier problem. The fractional quantum Hall problem has one phase, and it's gapped. And so it was merely a matter of writing down on a piece of paper a prototype for what this state was. In the superconductors, on the other hand, we have something very different. We have a multiplicity of phases, and they're competing with each other in ways we don't understand. And we don't understand if this competition is fundamental or an epiphenomenon. And we don't understand the energy scales. And we're not even sure we got all the order parameters identified properly of all these different orders. We can't even agree on whether finding these order parameters is important. I told this joke yesterday. Phil Anderson said he didn't want to encourage experimentalists to look for these order parameters because they might find them. If you understood the background, you'd laugh much harder. But anyway, so absolutely, I think it's a much harder problem and therefore a much more worthy problem. Yeah. Yeah, it's just hard. Now, this is not a trite answer. As technology evolves, all of us work the same way. We do the easy things first. And then we move on to harder things only when it becomes necessary. And very often, the limitations are fundamental and it requires a great breakthrough. to do better. So when Binning and Rohrer invented the scanning tunneling microscope, that was an astonishing invention, you see, because nobody ever tried it. Nobody ever believed you could tunnel into atoms. So they never bothered trying. So Binning and Rohrer tried it, and it turns out you can. You can with off-the-shelf components. You know, just little piezoelectric crystals like used to be in phonograph needles. So that was a great breakthrough, and now there's a revolution going on in measurement, which goes under the moniker of nano. I am sorry to say I had to mention the N-word in my talk. I normally don't like to do that because it's kind of run amok and run past the questions it's supposed to be answering. Part of this little preaching I'm doing here is to try to get the nano people focused on fundamental problems rather than just making gizmos. But anyway, the answer is to measure at those length scales is just very hard. If you get the wavelength, if you're measuring with light, which is what we usually like to do, the short wavelength required burn up the sample. No, ultraviolet kills you. That's why we want the ozone layer to be intact. So you get the wavelength down into the ultraviolet so you can measure the sizes, then you kill off the molecules. Or the scanning tunneling, in order to get the structure, you have to X-ray them. And in order to X-ray them, you have to make them crystallize. But when they crystallize, they're doing something different than what they do in vivo. So it just turns out because of the fact that the fine structure constant is small and the fact that neutrons are pernicious things to work with, that this length scale is just inaccessible. It just is. And I guess part of the reason for telling this little story is just to point out that the emperor has no clothes. It isn't true that this magnificent control exists. It's a no man's land, and that means probably there are just major discoveries to be made at that scale. The precedent of life is telling you something really miraculous is happening on this scale. Yeah.
Something miraculous certainly is happening on that scale, but it seems to me part of the important role is that it's strongly not equilibrium.
Ah.
And when you talk about protection, you're most likely talking about equilibrium phases.
Right.
And I just wonder to what extent you think understanding life is challenging. It is the challenge because it's microscopic, or because...
Great question. Now, let me paraphrase that question. Matthew says, the examples of protection we know occur in thermal equilibrium. And life, machinery of life, is not in thermal equilibrium. It's very important. If you're in thermal equilibrium, you're dead. And maybe that's the key thing. And I guess my answer is, I think not. And the reason I think not has to do with experimental science and just looking at what's known about the way proteins work. My take on the problem is that you just can't see, and that the ignorance comes from that, not from the fact that it's out of equilibrium. Now, the other point is that we know about self-organization at long length scales and equilibrium, mainly because we had things at long length scales and equilibrium and measured them. So that's one of the reasons for inventing a new word for the self-organization. You see, it isn't necessarily true that these universal self-organizations only happen at long energy scales and equilibrium. It isn't necessarily true. Those are the only things we know. And the reason we know them is because we observe them. So, if you have the idea that maybe there might be some new kind of extremely simple behavior that doesn't depend on model details, then you have a license to go look for it. So you see, this is the counter to Phil's argument that you don't want people to look because they'll find things. You see, I want people to look because they might win a Nobel Prize.
How about that?
Yeah.